Welcome back to the Universalis podcast. I am Martin Kohinski, the creator of Universalis, and in this episode I'll be looking at the highlights of the week ahead, starting with Sunday the 22nd of March. I was walking over the bridge yesterday, crossing the River Thames, and I looked out at it and the river was full, and I mean full. Now the Thames is a tidal river, so of course sometimes it is high and sometimes it is low. So ladders that climb down a wall to the river need to be long, steps that take you down to the water need to be long, because the water at its lowest is 20 feet below the water at its highest. I stood on the bridge for a moment and looked out over the river, and it was really full. Of the ladders up the embankment walls, you could barely see the tops. As for the steps leading down to the river, the water had covered them up, even the very top one, and it was trying to cover the path above. Looking at it all, I got a sense that the river itself was trying to bulge upwards towards the sky. I looked out at it, and as I looked, it all made sense. I hadn't thought of it this way before, but it is always like this between the fourth and fifth Sundays of Lent, between the healing of the man born blind and the raising of Lazarus. God did it. Or the Jews, our ancestors in the faith, did it to honour God. Because as the very first story in Genesis says, the sun and moon are not themselves gods, as the pagans thought. They are not divine, but they are useful. First, they are lamps to give us light and dark, day and night. And second, the way they dance round each other through the sky gives us seasons and months and festivals. So it is still true that we look up at them for the same reason the pagans looked up at them, in order to worship, but we don't worship them themselves. We use them to organise the worship of the one who made them and us. No pagan ever did that. Now the Jews, just like so many other peoples, end an old month and start a new one whenever the new moon appears. The moon was new this last week. This particular new moon marks the end of the Jewish month of Adar and the beginning of the month of Nisan, and the significance of that is that the middle of the month of Nisan is when the Passover happens. As we know, it was at the Passover that Jesus was arrested, tried, convicted, and crucified, and by rising from the dead set in motion the redemption of the world. So without directly intending it, the Jews arranged things so that the moon is always full at some point in our Holy Week. Indeed, that is always the first full moon of spring. Accordingly, the moon is always new 2 weeks earlier in the fourth week of Lent, between the man born blind and Lazarus. The beauty of it all is that every year at this time, the rivers and seas themselves combine to remind us that this is the week, now. I said earlier that it was as if the river was bulging. I didn't say enough. The river really is bulging, up towards the sun, which we can see, and the new moon, which we can't see when they are together in the sky. In this way, nature herself guides us in our celebration of salvation history. You could be poetic and say that the rivers are yearning upwards towards the heavens because our salvation is on the way. Just be a little bit careful with that, because the time of the highest high tides is also the time of the lowest low ones. 6 hours after the full river with its waters bulging up to heaven, every rung of every ladder will be exposed, with wide mud flats beneath and a strangely shrunken stream flowing in the middle of them. Whether we are thinking of religion or of civilization, there are times when we in England can feel terribly provincial. We are so far from the centre of the world. We have got our salvation from events that happened in Jerusalem, but that is 2,000 miles away. We have got our civilization from Greece and Rome, but they are 1,000 miles away. And here we are on the muddy, marshy periphery of it all. But our seas and rivers speak to us of God in a way that they can never speak to the Jews. All these glorious changes in the waters around us, which anyone can see, the Jews don't have them. From highest high water to lowest low water in London is 20 feet. You can't miss it. In Israel, the difference is just 1 foot. You'd have to be an expert or a pedant to notice it at all. With this spiritual reminder from the seas and rivers, we can wonder whether to be grateful for the generosity of the gift or feel a little embarrassed that God thought we needed a reminder like that. Let's not worry about it. Let's remember that the psalmist says, "The heavens proclaim the glory of God," and here we see them doing it, them and the waters. Everything proclaims it. The entire universe, with all its laws of nature, is like a love letter from God to us. Throughout history, the greatest scientists have seen it exactly like that, and their researches were their way of praising God by deciphering what he was saying. Isaac Newton, when he wasn't inventing calculus and the law of gravity and all that, made huge efforts to decode and understand the prophecies in the book of Daniel. Mendel, who worked out the theory of inheritance, was an Augustinian monk. Georges Lemaître, a Jesuit priest, was a pioneer in making sense of Einstein's equations of relativity. You could make an argument that all good science, in order to be good science, has to point beyond whatever it is studying towards the truth behind it all. None of this ought to need to be said, but we get so much noise from militant atheist preachers telling us that there is a contradiction between science and religion that we curl up in fear, too many of us, and don't dare to disbelieve them. In fact, those people are not only rotten theologians and useless philosophers, they are pretty mediocre scientists as well. But because we do need to resist such bullying and do need to stand up straight, let me carry on from something I was saying about the Divine Comedy last week. Dante Alighieri wrote this magnificent poem between 1307 and 1321. It is a story of a journey down through hell to the very bottom of it, then up a mountain called Purgatory on the other side of the world, where the sins are one by one healed, then up through the circles of heaven full of light and delight, until it ends beyond space, beyond time, in one single indescribable vision of God. You can read it as a spiritual journey. You can read it as a story of psychological healing and development. You can read it as a speculation of how life after death might work. You can read it as an exposition of theology. All sorts of things. It is, above all, a poem, but it is also a celebration of science. And I want to emphasize this now, when the science of the rivers and seas is telling us of the coming glory of God. I know that the very subject of science has been poisoned for too many of us by bullying pedants who taught it to us at school, and for some of us it has been ruined subsequently by being sold as a kind of anti-religion. But let's just set this aside for a few moments and look back to a time when not only was science full of excitement, but also a source of genuine delight and yet another way for us to love God who made it all. Dante delights in the achievements of modern science, and he is very careful about them. He puts Purgatory on a mountain 4,000 miles high, far above the atmosphere, exactly on the other side of the world from Jerusalem. In the middle of his poetic story of purification, salvation, and the rest, he insists on getting his scientific facts exactly right. He knows that in the southern hemisphere, our northern stars can't be seen, so there is no pole star, there is no great or little bear. But he knows there will be new constellations around the South Pole, which neither he nor any of his readers have seen or ever will see, and he invents them in a way that will suit his story. We all know that the sun for us, here in Europe, goes round the sky from left to right. Dante, the character in the poem, is shocked to find that in the southern hemisphere it goes from right to left, and Dante, the creator of the poem, enjoys laughing at the character's bewilderment. Even time zones, which are an annoyance to us and possibly even a bore, are a delight to Dante. He is forever reminding us of all the permutations, such as that when it's noon in Australia, it is morning in India and midnight in Jerusalem. You may not happen to have a taste for all of this, or perhaps your teachers ruined it for you. There is nothing more futile than trying to persuade someone into delight, but I do hope that somehow you will understand that this kind of delight in the orderedness of God's creation can be a delight, even if you yourself aren't able to enter into it. because ultimately, as a monk once told me, joy is the only reason God created the world at all. All that I've talked about so far, with the river and the tide and everything, will belong to last week by the time you listen to it. It is time to go forward, therefore, into this week, and indeed to confront the raising of Lazarus, which is the big gospel for Sunday the 22nd. Liturgically, of course, it makes entire sense to have the raising of Lazarus as part of the run-up to the resurrection, and the whole sequence of water of the Spirit, then giving sight to the blind, and then power over death, does feel like a logical one. I think that if we dig more deeply into the gospel of the raising of Lazarus, we may find there is more going on than just a final splendid display of power before the utter powerlessness of the Passion. So I want to try digging deeper. It may well be that I'm digging with the wrong tools or in the wrong place, but even if you decide that I am, all is not lost. You will have spent some time thinking deeply for yourself about this gospel, and that can never be bad. The raising of Lazarus isn't only the final miracle we celebrate in Lent. It also seems to have been the final healing miracle Jesus performed full stop. In various ways, it is a puzzling miracle too. The first puzzle about the story of Lazarus is this. In all the ways in which God has intervened in our world throughout the whole of salvation history, he has never made something not have happened. He has always stuck to the rule that what has happened has happened. If any divine intervention is needed, it happens in its due time. It is never retrospective. You might say, time always goes forwards. Look at the first public miracle of Jesus that we know, the wedding at Cana. The wine has run out. Either enough wasn't delivered, or people have drunk too much. In that case, why not just make the wine merchant not have forgotten to deliver that final cartload of wine? Or why not make the guests at the wedding not have been so thirsty? No. The thing that has happened, the wine running out, has to stay happened. If the final delivery was forgotten, it must stay forgotten forever. If too much wine was drunk, it must stay drunk. When Jesus performs his miracle, he has to do it in the present. In the particular case of the wedding party, you might call the miracle in the present more outrageous and more impossible than a miracle done in the past, because Jesus has to turn something into something that it isn't, turn water into wine. But you see, changing the past is never allowed. God can act only in the present. That's going to sound as if we are binding God by our rules, or God is binding himself. But there are reasons for this particular rule. Here is the main one. If God allows himself to go back in time and change things that have already happened, he is equally free to do that to us. So if I do a bad thing, he can, so to speak, unhappen it. He can run time over again so that this time I do the right thing. That means to say that I myself am no longer a free agent able to act freely, because whatever I do, God might cause me not to have done it. I am a puppet. I am a toy. But the whole point of creating us in the first place was for us not to be puppets, not to be toys, to be free agents in the image of God. To summarize this argument, God changing the past is nothing more, nothing less, than God contradicting God. And now look at Sunday's Gospel. Lazarus, when Jesus gets to Bethany, has most definitely died. He has been dead for days. He stinks already. The only way to raise him is to make him not have died. And making things not have happened is the one thing God never does. And yet, looking at the story, it seems that this time the incarnate God is doing exactly what God never does. He is taking Lazarus's death and making it not have happened. That is, to say the least of it, a puzzle. There is a second puzzle about the raising of Lazarus, and it lies in the circumstances. Jesus brought this whole situation on himself. He knew Lazarus was ill. He had time to go to Bethany in time to save Lazarus's life, and he didn't go. The Gospel account has a confused tone to it here, because the disciples really were confused. Perhaps Jesus was too. The third puzzle about this Gospel is the one I've already touched on. The raising of Lazarus seems to be special in that it is Jesus' final healing miracle. Thinking about it, I wonder if perhaps every ministry with healing in it has to have a limited lifespan. However wonderful the teaching of Jesus was, and remember, people came a long way to hear it and stayed listening all day, hungry in the hot sun. As time went on, in people's minds, the healing would eventually overwhelm every other consideration. Suppose that you had a blind son or a daughter with a deadly illness, and you knew Jesus was in the next town. Would you go to him? Of course you would. Would you care what he said as long as he healed your child? Quite possibly you would not. Given that it couldn't go on forever, it had to come to an end. Given that there had to be a last miracle, it seems right that it should have been a final miracle in some deeper sense. Right also that this miracle should be for the family Jesus loved best. And somehow, but it's beyond me to explain exactly how, it may have been right that such a very final miracle should be needed because of Jesus himself deciding to delay 2 days before going to Bethany. And now let's go there ourselves, to Bethany, to meet Martha once again. I may be all wrong about this, but I feel that Martha is about to teach Jesus something that he needed to learn, that the Father knew he needed to learn. Jesus went about the earth doing good. We know this. Doing good is good, but there is a sense in which it can turn out to be too easy. For instance, you see a beggar sitting in the street holding up a piece of cardboard saying, "Help me to pay for my hostel tonight." You want to help, and you don't just want to throw a coin at him and look the other way. So you go to the hostel he is staying at, and you take out a fat handful of money, enough for a whole month's stay, and you give it to them. In doing that, what have you done? Have you helped the beggar? Yes, you have, much more than you would have by throwing coins. But have you even for an instant shared in his feeling of homelessness? No, you have not. Because the instant you knew he was homeless, you abolished that homelessness. He stopped experiencing it, which is good, but you yourself never even experienced it at all. You were never side by side with the one you helped. Jesus healed many people of many things, but perhaps, just perhaps, his experience of healing was too much like yours with the beggar and the hostel. The instant he met someone who needed healing, that person didn't need healing any more. Now, at Bethany, we have Martha. Martha from the family Jesus loves. Martha, whose brother is dead. Martha, for whom no miracle can decently be performed, because making something not have happened would not be decent. All Jesus, the miracle worker, can do is be there with her, and not commit a miracle, only share her grief. And so Jesus weeps. Look how carefully Martha speaks in this Gospel passage. She never quite reproaches and never quite asks. Even broken by grief, she is a strong, down-to-earth woman. She says, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." That is no reproach. It is a simple statement of fact. She says, "Whatever you ask from God, God will give you." That is no request. It is a simple statement of fact. She says, "I know that my brother will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." That is true as far as it goes, but she knows, and Jesus knows, that if she had gone on with that sentence, the next word she said would have been "but." She also says, "I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world." She has all the knowledge and all the faith, but also she has all the desolation. We too have our desolations. We too sometimes have to go on living and enduring after we have received a blow that is too hard to endure. This is quite a good moment to pause in considering the Gospel and just be with Martha. to be with all people who are desolate and don't know how they can go on. There is no decent answer one can give to people like that unless one is in the same desolation with them or has been in something very like it. But just now in the story, where Martha is where Jesus is also, so we, hearing the story, know that Jesus has been there, and so we, even in our worst moments, can share that place with Jesus. Beyond that, as I say, nothing decent can be said. One thing we can do is remember what Jesus hasn't taught us to say. The Lord's Prayer does not say, "Give us tomorrow our daily bread." There is a reason. We are not meant to think of tomorrow. Much of the intolerability of a world turned suddenly to ash is the thought of all those tomorrows that wait to be got through, ash after ash after ash, day after day. So don't try to handle that thought. Give it to Jesus to carry. He asked for our cares. Give them to him. You hold on to today. Get through today. Back in the Gospel, then, Mary comes and joins Jesus and Martha, and Mary says much the same sort of thing that Martha said. There they are, then, the three of them, all united in the same desolation. Only Jesus can decide what to do, and he does decide. If he raises Lazarus from the dead, it will be the final act of his healing ministry. That may be because in making Lazarus not have died, God will be breaking the rule that God has set himself, that what has happened has to stay happened. Even if all that theory about happening is wrong, and the miracle Jesus is about to perform is to turn decomposing flesh into a human being and breathe life into it, still, this will still have to be the final healing miracle, because doing it so close to Jerusalem and in front of so many witnesses is going to set in motion unstoppable historical forces and lead to the final act of the atonement and the salvation of all mankind. Either way, if Jesus performs this miracle, nothing will ever be the same again. Jesus calls, "Lazarus, come out," and out Lazarus comes. There are very few saints' days in Lent because the Church likes to move them out of the penitential period so they can be celebrated properly. But you can't possibly ignore the Annunciation, which is the true feast of the Incarnation, and so we celebrate it this Wednesday, the 25th. Mary, the mother of Jesus, is the latest in a line of strong women who run like a backbone through the length of salvation history. Remember Sarah, the wife of Abraham, who laughed at the idea that she would have a child. Remember the mother of Moses, whose name we don't even know. She cleverly saved her son's life. Remember Hannah, who Eli thought was drunk when she prayed so passionately to the Lord for a son. Eli apologized afterwards, and the son Hannah bore was Samuel, the great judge of Israel. And there are many more. Mary follows in their tradition. Her "Let it be done to me as you have said" is not mere meek consent. It is a decision which changed the course of human history, just as the course of history was changed by the decision Eve made in the Garden of Eden. As for the readings at Mass, every day's readings are important this close to Holy Week. Read them all in Universalis. Especially read the ones for Monday, because the first reading at Mass on Monday is actually rather fun. It is the story of Susanna and the elders and the young Daniel. It sometimes turns up in anthologies as the world's oldest detective story. That's all for this week. If you'd like to write to us about anything, send an email to universalis@universalis.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Have a good week in every sense, and let's pray for one another.